Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Michael Toscano. A missile fired by Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels came down in an open area of central Israel early today in support of Palestinians in Gaza.
The Israeli army said the ballistic missile apparently fell apart in the air over Israel, sparking air raid sirens across central Israel. Several people were slightly wounded running to shelters. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel will retaliate. They should know that we exact a heavy price from anyone who tries to hurt us, Netanyahu said. Linda Gradstein for CBS News, Jerusalem.
Republican vice presidential nominee Senator J.D. Vance is defending his use of stories labeled false by town officials that Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio are stealing and eating pets. Vance told CBS.
Now, you said that these are false rumors. Well, I've heard about a dozen things from my constituents in Springfield, Ohio. 10 of them are verifiable and confirmable. A couple of them we have direct firsthand accounts.
Pennsylvania's Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro says he's worried by bomb threats there.
This is dangerous stuff. I know it started because they wanted to just distract the American people from their failed policies and their chaos, but this has now taken on a life of its own because of what they incited.
Shapiro was on CNN State of the Union. Three massive wildfires are ablaze in Southern California, including the Bridge Fire, which spread from Los Angeles to San Bernardino County. CBS News Los Angeles reporter Rick Montanez says there is progress in fighting
minimal growth. That's what they are saying about the fire. Firefighters are putting out hot spots, which is good news. All of this smoke and haze, I mean, it is thick. You can smell it. You can taste it.
Public hearings will get underway tomorrow into the implosion of the submersible Titan that killed five people on its way down to the Titanic. Jason Neubauer heads the panel looking for answers.
These proceedings are not just a formality. They are a critical step in our mission to understand the contributing factors that led to the incident, and even more importantly, the actions needed to prevent a similar occurrence.
Senator Lindsey Graham says he wants Ukraine to be able to use weapons it's received from allies to strike inside Russia.
Air bases inside of Russia are being used to kill Ukrainian civilians. Most NATO allies would like Ukraine to be able to use the weapons more effectively. Yes, do not let Putin set policy.
Senator Graham was on Fox News Sunday. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Seth here, host of Over the Back Fence. We're on the air live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., taking your calls to buy or sell, talk local events, or whatever, only on WFHR.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Congress has about 2 weeks to pass a bill to keep the federal government running. Advocates say they hope consumer protection efforts don't face budget cuts. Mike Mohn reports.
Over the summer, House Republicans floated cuts in certain areas, including a 27% funding decrease for the Federal Trade Commission. Aaron Witte of the Consumer Federation of America says the timing couldn't be worse for that type of move.
We've seen people talk a lot about feeling like their costs are increased in lots of ways. And the FTC's work is really aimed at trying to lower a lot of those costs to bring some fairness back to the process.
Last month, the agency co-hosted the first meeting of a task force about whether companies are price gouging and the impact on consumers. GOP leaders on the Appropriations Committee say they want a financial services bill that prioritizes combating terrorism financing, maintaining the integrity of financial markets, and spurring small business growth. Witte contends the FTC has made progress in standing up for consumers with great efficiency. She points to the proposed click-to-cancel rule that would remove barriers for people worried about recurring charges for an unwanted subscription for a service or product.
That would make it as easy for someone to cancel a subscription as it is to sign up for it. And that proposal has gotten thousands of comments from consumers about how much time they are wasting on things like unnecessary subscriptions.
And the state-level organization Opportunity Wisconsin has also cited concerns about consumer protections being gutted. It's unclear if any of the budget ideas floated over the past several months will find their way into a final spending plan. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm. Otherwise, some sunshine and a high near 83. Partly cloudy, 62 tonight. Mostly sunny for Monday, highs around 85. Sunshine, 83 for Tuesday. Sunny and 81 on Wednesday.
Right now, it's 87.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Andra Watkins returns. She grew up in a Christian nationalist household and can tell us how that relates to Project 2025. It's not good. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, this is Amicus, a law review, our weekly weekend review of all things court-related, justice-related, and matters related to the aspiration for justice in America, including lots of our operations of government, both local, state, and federal. Thank you once again for joining me on our weekend broadcast. This is Amicus, a law review. We take our name, as always, our adopted commission to conduct a review, an analysis, some deliberation, some consideration of the most recent news stories of our times in those areas that are important to our lives and our livelihood. Amicus, of course, coming from the Latin, it's also a legal term meaning friend, an individual, an organization that assists in understanding or appreciation, some assessment of some relevant issues or questions that need to be resolved, need to be addressed in some way, most typically by a court, but not always, sometimes by another entity, some private, some public entity that's got some responsibility for decision-making in our lives, and thus the name of our weekend weekly broadcast, Amicus, a law review, focusing once again on significant news items of the week, sometimes beyond, here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted, as always, to have you be a part of our discussion. That can happen a couple of different ways. You can call in to me and to my superb producer, Max, and you can get to us at 844-967-2789. That telephone number, once again, 844-967-2789, or you can also drop a note into the Civic Media app and let us know about your question, your inquiry about anything on our ambitious but achievable agenda, our syllabus, our academic review this weekend in these areas. Be a part of our discussion. And again, delighted to have you with me, honored to have you a part of our presentation, our program here on Civic Media. Let's talk about what is on the syllabus for this weekend show. Again, lots and lots of things happening in the world of government and justice and law generally. We're going to spend the first hour talking about a number of different issues that have animated a lot of the news stories in this past week. We're going to begin by talking about the Violence Against Women Act, the 30th anniversary of VAWA just this past week. We're going to talk about some things that President Biden said, but also remember something that the Supreme Court did not recently, but a number of years ago, to undermine, to stop some portions of VAWA as it was initially enacted. We'll think about that and talk about the consequences, not only of VAWA, the very positive things that it has done in the context of an otherwise very challenging area, violence against women, and also expanded to include men legislatively and operationally. We're also going to chat about a somewhat related subject, and that is Merrick Garland, Attorney General, who is responsible in large part for administering, for executing the law, VAWA. Also spent some time this past week talking about the dangerous and outrageous attacks on the Department of Justice and prosecutors, investigators, personnel inside the government, the consequences of those, chastising those people who would make those attacks, those threats. We'll talk about what exactly he said, why those words from our chief federal law enforcement officer are so very, very important to understanding our lives. And then we're also going to talk about something else related to the Department of Justice, and that is its continuing prosecution. Yes, indeed, they continue to this day, and that is the prosecution of individuals, the identification, the investigation of people who were responsible for the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. We'll talk about one of the recently charged defendants. We are still identifying and charging them. A present Army soldier charged with involvement in the attack, the insurrection on January 6th. And then we'll talk about what the Department of Justice is doing in the wake of that major case issued by the Supreme Court, not the immunity case, but that Fisher matter that restricted the ways in which one of the particular statutes used by the government, by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, restricting the use of that and its impact upon some of the many, many hundreds of defendants who've now been charged, some subset of them affected in terms of the judgments, the jury verdicts, the findings previously entered against them. We'll talk about the consequences of the Supreme Court's decision in Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R, on those various prosecutions. And then finally, in this first hour on Amicus, we're going to be talking about two matters involving Donald Trump. One of them related to the continuing prosecution, the litigation of cases in Georgia, in particular in Fulton County. The impact of what the presiding judge in Fulton County did this past week with respect to two of the many remaining counts in the indictment against Donald Trump and many others there alleging election interference. We'll talk about what Judge Scott McAfee did, his orders dismissing two more counts in that indictment. What are the consequences of that? What does that mean? How did he come to that result? And we'll also update you on the status generally of the appeal in that case related to whether the prosecutor, Fani Willis, can continue to prosecute the case as that matter moves forward, even without a set trial date, no date coming up in this calendar year. And then another case, completely unrelated, but for the fact that it involves a similar defendant or close defendant, his name once again, Donald Trump. I'm going to talk about what a Cook County judge in Northern Illinois did just this past week in connection with something called the Illinois Environmental Protection Act. What did that judge find with respect to Trump Tower in downtown Chicago? What did he find? What violations did he find that were being perpetrated by the leadership, the organization, the management of Trump Tower, this major building that has the former president's present candidate for the presidency, his name emblazoned boldly on the side of that building just along the Chicago River? A major decision by a Cook County judge in the environmental area finding environmental violations by the Trump Organization in its management and supervision of that particular building related to water and related to fish in that water. We'll talk about exactly what that means. A split count, if you will. This past week, Donald Trump successful in getting two additional counts dismissed in that criminal prosecution in Georgia, not successful in defending against an environmental claim in Chicago in Northern Illinois. We'll talk all about that. And then in our second major hour, two other significant stories, again, of this past week, but also of previous weeks. This past week, we saw the initiation, finally, of the trial of the police officers involved in the brutal beating of Tyree Nichols, this 29-year-old FedEx worker, January 2023, by Memphis police. The trial of those police for civil rights violations, criminal violations of the federal law began this past week at a federal district court in Memphis. We'll remind you what Tyree Nichols' death was all about, why that happened, how that happened, and describe something of what we're already hearing inside the trial of that case, including some stunning revelations about some of the language used by police officers, including a run tax, a slogan, a linguistic flourish, if you will, a dark reference by law enforcement when it comes to the work that they are supposed to be doing on behalf of the constituencies of Memphis. We'll talk about why that phrase is significant in understanding, trying to understand what happened to Tyre Nichols, the death at the hands of police officers there in Memphis, most of them now on trial, some of them having pled guilty and testifying in that case in the weeks just ahead. We revisit what happened to Tyre Nichols and the present litigation, the criminal litigation against those people, those police officers who took his life back in January of 2023. And then we're going to return to an issue that we raised just at the end of our last broadcast last weekend. And that relates to the attempts by our federal government to address the involvement of Russia in the 2024 election. We have seen this story. We have witnessed this play once before, and it is back. Last week, we hinted at the story coming up in greater detail in the second hour of this broadcast related to what the United States Department of Justice is doing, including its prosecution of a couple of people responsible for attempting to undermine our 2024 campaign and the 2024 election results. Just this past week, in addition to that Department of Justice information, we also had the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, likewise talking about what the State Department, another agency of the federal government, what the State Department is doing in that same connection, responding with sanctions and other remedies to address what it has perceived as a very significant impact, a very significant threat posed by Russia, Russia entities and Russia adjacent entities trying to counter the votes and the campaign progress with respect to all voting in America. We'll talk about what Antony Blinken said, complimenting being a part of this government-wide, this one government approach to addressing Russian interference in, yes, the 2024 election, the 2024 campaign now underway, talking about all of that in the courts, out of the courts, all of that here on this weekend broadcast of Amicus, a law review, inviting you, as always, to join us for that discussion as we undertake it now in the moments and the hours just ahead. My name, Jim Santel, inviting your comments and inquiries at 844-967-2789. Also, asking for your insight, your perspectives, your questions, your inquiries about anything on our subject matter this weekend. Let's begin by talking about, yes, that's right, it's the 30th anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act. The 30th anniversary, 30 years ago, just this past week, this major, major legislation that changed the way in which the federal government, and yes, indeed, the state government, private entities, respond to the victim survivors of crime in America. It is a major, major piece of legislation, remains a significant tool in the toolbox of prosecutors and victim rights specialists, both inside the government and outside the government, when it comes to addressing the special needs and special interests, the special focus of victims across the panoply of crimes in America. The name of it has become a bit of a misnomer because while initially introduced and passed as the Violence Against Women Act, based upon an awful lot of present and past indication that women suffer inordinately from violence, also expanded to include men. And so virtually all of the aspects of the law now including across the board everyone who might be a victim survivor of crime in America. Also, one of the major legislative pieces introduced by our current president, Joseph Biden, when he was in the United States Senate. As we continue our discussion, let's talk about VAWA, the 30th anniversary, and what the Supreme Court did way back a number of years ago in 2000 with respect to its important role in America as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Matt Nair on air.
Join our advertising family on WFHR and WIRI and see how radio can help improve awareness, revenue, and staffing for your business. I'm Ashley, and it's my mission to help our area businesses thrive. Call me today, 715-496-0710.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast form? Search no more. Find it now on WFHR.com. Your news, just for Wisconsin Rapids and surrounding communities. I'm Melissa Kay with WFHR News.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well, as we talk about major stories in government and law, the aspiration for justice in America and beyond, beginning in this weekend broadcast, talking about VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, recognizing just this past week the commemoration of 30 years since VAWA has been the law of our land. It is a piece of legislation that was introduced 30 years ago when Senator Joseph Biden was in the United States Congress. And this past week, President Joseph Biden commemorated and talked about the reasons why VAWA was important, remains hugely important to the administration of law in our nation, and also to protect and safeguard the rights and prerogatives and the positions of victims of crime. Recall well that VAWA, this Violence Against Women Act, saw the increase in justice generally for survivors of crime, accountability for the perpetrators, not just through criminal prosecution and sentencing, but also in other ways as well, created the first ever national hotline with respect to violence, specifically toward women, supported shelters and rape crisis centers, housing opportunities, legal assistance for women not previously available to them all across the country, districts in every part of our nation. Training for police officers and prosecutors and various private and public advocates, judges, court personnel, basically designed to make our justice system more fair, respond to the needs of victim survivors, again, women and men alike. Over time, the law has been expanded as the Congress has acted to recognize increased needs among victim survivors, expanded to increase access to sexual assault services on places like college campuses, very important, invested in ending the backlog of rape kits, which we have seen in many states, including right here in Wisconsin over time, increasing protections for underserved communities of various natures. Hugely important in changing the ways in which U.S. attorneys and assistant U.S. attorneys and federal investigators, and most importantly, those people who support the victim survivors of crime, engage in that all-important work, providing the tools, the mechanisms, and yes, indeed, the funding to make all of that happen. Congress passing that way back 30 years ago, just this past week. Significant on the 30th anniversary to remember what happened in 2000, the year 2000, again, 24 years ago, when the United States Supreme Court did something to carve away some of those features, at least one of them, that the Congress had passed. The justices split in a 5-4 vote in a case called United States versus Morrison. United States versus Morrison is the name of the case. It was authored by then Chief Justice William Rehnquist. He, of course, hails from Wisconsin. And at that time, in that Morrison case, the court had before it this question about the legitimacy of a particular provision of VAWA as it had been passed at that time. Specifically, the court approved striking down a provision of the law that let gender-based violence victims sue the perpetrators of that crime, those crimes, in federal court, giving them a private right of action, the opportunity to sue in civil court, not criminal court, on behalf of themselves and other people affected by that criminal activity. The only justice from that particular ruling who's still in the court today, Clarence Thomas, And he joined Rehnquist's majority opinion. In that opinion, Rehnquist, on behalf of the majority, again, 5-4, a split almost right down ideological lines, Rehnquist wrote that the Congress lacked the authority to enact the specific gender-based violence victim protection under VAWA. Part of the majority's decision or rationale for that conclusion was the Commerce Clause in the Constitution, of all things, and that, of course, gives Congress the authority to regulate interstate commerce, among other aspects of its authority. Gender-motivated crimes of violence are not, in any sense of the phrase, economic activity, the court wrote. That was the Chief Justice William Rehnquist striking down that portion of the law that gave victims, survivors of crime, the capacity to sue their perpetrators in federal court. Dissenting justices, and there were four of them, vigorous dissents, pointing out that the mountain of data assembled by Congress continues to be reviewed every single year, showing the effects of violence against women on interstate commerce. The majority writing that it rejected the argument that Congress may regulate non-economic, violent criminal conduct based solely on that conduct's aggregate effect on interstate commerce. Now, that's a lot. That's a lot. Basically, what you have there is the dissenting justices saying, no, if you read the Commerce Clause broadly enough, as the courts have done in the past, you cannot only find a place for this provision inside the Commerce Clause, but it is comfortably right in that. Nonetheless, the rule in United States versus Morrison, the carve out for that particular provision, that affected way back in 2000 by the Supreme Court case, United States versus Morrison. Nonetheless, VAWA remains the law of the land in many, many other areas, continues to be invoked routinely, virtually every day in our nation by U.S. attorneys' offices, by victim witness support units, by private sectors, public sectors, in this all-important attempt to address the special needs and interests and prerogatives and positions of victims nationwide. We recognize just this past week the 30-year anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act in all of its iterations, all of that happening just this past week. We also know coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice just this past week, another major event, Merrick Garland, whose staff, through the Assistant Attorneys General, through the Associate Attorney General, through U.S. attorneys, 92 of them nationwide, responsible for invoking and applying VAWA. This past week, Attorney General Merrick Garland addressing staff of the Department of Justice nationwide and denouncing what he called dangerous and outrageous attacks on Department of Justice prosecutors and personnel. He said in particular, in a speech that was sometimes emotional, very forceful, and he appeared to allude to all kinds of accusations and threats made unmistakably by President Donald Trump, even though not naming him by name in his speech. Of course, Donald Trump presently campaigning to return to the presidency, Garland not explicitly naming him, but nonetheless thanking the Department of Justice workers for their dedication in the face of what the Attorney General said was an escalation of attacks on the Justice Department's career lawyers and agents and other personnel over the last 3.5 years, noting this jump in these dangerous and outrageous attacks on the prosecutors and other personnel responsible for the administration of justice. Those attacks, he said, have come in the form of conspiracy theories, dangerous falsehoods, efforts to bully and intimidate public servants by repeatedly and publicly singling them out, threats of actual violence. It is dangerous, he said. It's outrageous that you have to endure them. And again, he's speaking directly to members of the Department of Justice staff. It's dangerous to target and intimidate individual employees of this department simply for doing their jobs. And it is outrageous, he said, that you have to face these unfounded attacks because you are doing what is right and upholding the rule of law. Receiving heavy applause when he said the way you do that work makes clear that the public servants of the Department of Justice do not bend to politics and that they will not break under pressure. Again, not specifically invoking Donald Trump, but unmistakably making reference to threats that he has advanced along with other conspiracy theories. More on this and other aspects of the rule of law when Amicus, a law review, continues on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
Locally Grown Radio, WFHR.
CBS News Brief. We are just getting reports coming in that former President Donald Trump is safe following gunshots which went off in his vicinity. That says that is from his campaign. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Houthi rebels will pay a heavy price after they fired a missile into central Israel.
The IDF said the weapon landed in an uninhabited area on Sunday morning, but shrapnel indicated air defense systems had failed to destroy it before it entered Israeli airspace.
That's the BBC's Gurvinda Gill. Ohio's GOP Governor Mike DeWine is debunking tales of pet-eating immigrants.
The Haitians who are in Springfield are legal. They came to Springfield to work. Ohio is on the move, and Springfield has really made a great resurgence.
DeWine was on ABC's This Week. Tonight is the Emmy Awards that come up at 8 p.m. on ABC. This is CBS News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
The Packers march on. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. The Green Bay Packers will start Malik Willis today in place of the injured Jordan Love, who was listed as doubtful for today's game against the Colts with an MCL sprain. The Packers elevated Sean Clifford from the practice squad to the active roster yesterday to serve as a backup. Willis says he has been preparing and knows he needs to be ready at any given moment to contribute.
I've been pretty much around the clock since I got here. That's the reality of this thing. You try to come in and be ready to go if you're called upon. And like you say, you just work each day.
The Packers and Colts kick off at noon. Yesterday, it was Alabama blowing out Wisconsin 42-10 in college football. Wisconsin has a week off before playing at number 11 USC on September 28th. It was a wild night in Arizona as the Brewers piled up 15 runs in a 15-8 win over the Diamondbacks. The win reduced the Brewers' magic number to 3. Same two teams, Brewers and Diamondbacks, will play again this afternoon. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cusco with Civic Media Sports.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm. Otherwise, some sunshine and a high near 83. Partly cloudy, 62 tonight. Mostly sunny for Monday, highs around 85. Sunshine, 83 for Tuesday. Sunny and 81 on Wednesday.
Right now, it's 87.
Get ready to go for the green or gold with Civic Media's new Text to Win contest. When you go for the green or gold, you could win $100 cash, gold jewelry, and be entered to win our grand prize, two indoor club-level seats to see the green and gold in Green Bay. Download the free Civic Media app and get ready to text in for your first chance to win in this statewide contest starting Monday, September 16th. Get ready to go for the green or gold with your local Civic Media radio station.
Dynamite! Do you catch yourself quoting TV shows like that? It could win you a free meal and make you our next star of the day with Culver's. Join the morning show on WFHR every Friday.
What you talking about, Willis?
My name's James, and I'm telling people every Friday we'll play a theme song or a quote from a movie.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give it.
You call 424-2600, give the correct answer, and you'll win a family pack from our Wisconsin Rapids Culver's.
To the Batmobile.
Join the morning show every Friday for Culver's Star of the Day.
I love it when a plan comes together.
At Fleet Farm, we know every opening day doesn't begin and end with us. But if it did, we've got you covered. Everyday hunting gear from Winchester, Remington, and Bear. Everyday fishing gear from Daiwa, St. Croix, and Rapala. Everyday yard cleanup from Scott's, Fiskars, and Agri-Fab. Whatever makes your day, we're right there with you. At Fleet Farm, we've got everything you need for everyday life.
When severe weather hits and the power goes out, do you have a plan? For reliable power and peace of mind, propane can do that. It only takes about 10 seconds for a propane-powered generator to restore power to your home. So no matter what Mother Nature has in store, you know you're prepared. Learn more at WIPGA.org. This message is sponsored by your local propane provider and the Wisconsin Propane Education and Research Council.
Pete Schwaba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome entertainment critic and CityCast Madison newsletter editor Rob Thomas. And tis the season, so we'll talk about our favorite political movies.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well, as we talk about things in the areas of justice, government, and law. Thank you for joining me on our weekend broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking about this major address given by the Attorney General of the United States, his name Merrick Garland, to staff personnel of the Department of Justice, but really intended for all of us in America, 340 million people, talking about the danger that is being presented by these continuing threats, these conspiracy theories, falsehoods, efforts to bully and intimidate public officials, including those of the Department of Justice, in doing their jobs. Main thrust of the Attorney General's remarks just this past week is that every American equal under the law. Also, unmistakably, a message to Donald Trump. He says this, that is the Attorney General, there is not one rule for friends and another for foes, one rule for the powerful and another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, or different rules depending on one's race or ethnicity. All of that coming from the voice of the Attorney General. To the contrary, he said, we have only one rule. We follow the facts and we apply the law in a way that respects the Constitution and protects civil liberties. He said that he and other department officials, there are many of them there at Maine Justice throughout the country as well, will be fiercely protecting the Department of Justice's independence from what he called political interference in our criminal investigations. He says, we'll not allow the department to be used as a political weapon. We'll not allow law enforcement to be treated as an apparatus of politics. Describe some of the steps the department has already taken to protect the criminal and civil decisions of the department, like reinstating policies regulating communication between department employees and Congress and the White House, again, to stop any politicization of communications there. Other actions he described, including improving clarifying guidelines for sensitive FBI investigations, publishing new policies to guide prosecutorial discretion with respect to charging, pleas, and sentencing, all of that, once again, to promote the legitimacy, the ethical approach to investigation and prosecution by your Department of Justice. And then he went on to talk about the attacks on prosecutors. He said this, you deserve better. You deserve gratitude for the noble and difficult work you do. You deserve recognition for the integrity and skill with which you do that work. You also have my promise, he said, that nothing will ever stop me from defending this department and the extraordinary people who work here. Since leaving office in 2021, Donald Trump has repeatedly lashed out at the Department of Justice and its investigators, unmistakably the focus of the Attorney General's words just this past week. While the Trump campaign did not specifically respond to what the Attorney General has said, there's no doubt that the former president and campaigner for the presidency has called DOJ employees derogatory names. He's called Special Counsel Jack Smith, who has charged Donald Trump in two separate cases through the grand jury process, called him deranged. He also has threatened prosecutors, saying in a Truth Social post, you may recall well, and part of this alluding to the 2020 election interference charges against him, he said, if you go after me, I'm coming after you. And beyond that, he has targeted other members of the Department of Justice as they have attempted to do their jobs in all of this undertaking. During the course of that six-week trial in which the defendant, Donald Trump, was ultimately found guilty of 34 violations of New York law, recall well that almost on a nearly basis, he was attacking the Biden Justice Department, being weaponized against him. He said that the Biden administration, through the Department of Justice, through Merrick Garland, had brought this case, when in fact, that's nothing could be further from the truth. It was brought by a state prosecutor, his name Alvin Bragg. Again, just this past week, the Attorney General pushing back on these attempts to intimidate and to threaten the Department of Justice and saying he will do all he can do to push back on all of that and ensure the legitimacy of prosecutions, investigations based upon the law and the facts and not being in any way affected by the political attacks that unmistakably have been a part of Donald Trump's statements publicly in America. This past week also saw some significant movement in connection with the continuing prosecutions of individuals responsible for the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. Two significant things of note just this past week. Biden administration, again, through the Department of Justice, announced some interesting results of this major decision of the Supreme Court in that Fisher case. The Fisher case, you may recall well, describing this notion, providing a broad interpretation, the notion of a statute that imposes up to 20 years in prison for those who corruptly obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding. And that particular statute, 18 U.S.C. 1512, invoked with respect to the prosecutions of many people, including a fellow named Fisher, who said that that particular statute cannot apply to him because he wasn't involved in any documents. He wasn't involved in any papers, any physical materials. And in Fisher versus United States, the Supreme Court agreed with him and said you can't use that simply for broad obstructive acts. You've got to identify some specific documents, some papers, some materials that were impeded or they were affected in some way as a result of the conduct of the defendant. And since the ruling in Fisher then, the Department of Justice has gone back and looked at those, more than a handful, but a number of defendants who were charged and convicted under Section 1512. 60 out of 126 defendants have had their pending obstruction charges dismissed as a result of the decision by the United States in that Fisher case, according to information just released recently by the U.S. Department of Justice. Of the 133 defendants whose cases were already resolved before that Fisher decision, before the Supreme Court limited the application of the statute, the department indicated that it does not oppose dismissal or vacatur, which is basically removing the effect of the judgment of the charge in approximately 40 cases and continues to assess the rest. And basically, in a number of cases, said we're not going to drop prosecutions. In other cases where we can, in fact, meet what the Supreme Court has said, we can, in fact, show the defendants engaged in conduct that involved papers and documents and movement of those kinds of things as a part of the overall charge to obstruct or influence or impede an official proceeding. Of course, that official proceeding was the counting of electoral votes on January 6th in the wake of the election of 2020. The Department of Justice, accordingly to reporting, is still pursuing obstruction charges for 13 defendants and evaluating some of its next steps for remaining cases. Among those, for example, prosecutors have said that defendants Don and Shawndell Chilcote, in a case involving them, that there is sufficient evidence to suggest that those two siblings, brother and sister from Ohio, understood that their trek into the Senate floor would in fact block Congress from meeting. And under the circumstances of what they did, the prosecution of them under the Fisher statute under 1512 would continue. And so even as the Department of Justice appropriately following what the Supreme Court has said, even while that continues to happen, the reality is that the Department of Justice dismissing some, not a huge number, but some of those cases pending there in the federal district court, vacating some of the judgments and declining to prosecute further some of those cases that otherwise would have brought many, many defendants charged both under Section 1512 and other statutes, those continue, including Mr. Fisher himself. Six other counts beyond the Fisher statute. Mr. Fisher also still facing imposition and sentencing for those as well. So all of that coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice just this past week. In connection with that, the Department of Justice continues, as I said, to identify and prosecute people who are responsible for engaging in this kind of behavior. And another one of just this past week, among the hundreds of people, well over 1,000 now, who've been prosecuted in the wake of the January 6th riot. Let's talk about U.S. Army soldier Alexander Poplin. He was arrested this past week in the barracks, the Schofield Barracks. It was an Army installation near Honolulu. Poplin, who is 31 years old, he comes from Hawaii, scheduled to make his initial appearance in federal court just this past week, arrested on charges that he repeatedly struck a police officer with a flagpole during his attack and the attack of the mob, the rioters, on January 6th, more than 3 years ago. And that, according to the court records, of course, all of the information provided in the public domain just this past week. The FBI apparently identified him this way, as is often the case. They received a tip in February of 2021 that Poplin, again, this military individual, had posted on Facebook about attacking police during the Capitol riot. He wrote on Facebook that we took our house back and we stood for something, is what he wrote. July of 2024, an FBI investigator interviewed Poplin's military supervisor, who identified Poplin in a photograph showing him wearing an Army camouflage backpack inside the restricted area of the Capitol. Yes, on January 6th of 2021. All of that is a part of the investigation. Poplin attended then-President Donald Trump's Stop the Steal rally earlier that day near the White House on the Ellipse. He joined the mob of supporters who gathered at the Capitol, where lawmakers, again, were counting votes, counting those electoral votes coming in from states across the nation. On the Capitol's Lower West Plaza, many of you have probably have been right there, Poplin, according to the allegations in the charges against him, carried an area closed sign in his left hand and a flagpole bearing a blue flag in his right hand. A video actually captured him repeatedly striking a Metropolitan Police Department officer with the flagpole. He was arrested on a complaint charging with five counts, including felony charges of interfering with the police during a civil disorder, and yes, assaulting and resisting and impeding police with a dangerous weapon, plainly that flagpole. Nearly 1,500 people have been charged with these kinds of Capitol-related federal crimes. Many rioters were military veterans, but only a handful, like Poplin, were on active duty. He was among them. And approximately 140 police officers, as we know, were injured in that attack. Several of them have lost their lives, as did other individuals on that attack on our nation, on our Capitol, on January 6th. Just this past week, Alexander Poplin, the latest defendant to be charged by the federal government, while he is serving in our United States military, certainly will be discharged promptly. We always hasten to add that he is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Compelling evidence, however, finding, obviously, under this criminal complaint, almost certainly to be indicted now by a grand jury, finding probable cause to believe that he committed that offense conduct, continuing to monitor that prosecution, in addition to all the others, whether they're subject to Fisher or not, other statutes brought forward by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, by the Department of Justice, in an attempt to address the violent criminal behaviors of people on January 6th, not only to deter them in the future, perhaps including as soon as November, about 50 days from now, and times after that, regardless of what the result of the election may be, deterring them individually, but also deterring other people, as we have often spoke on this broadcast. That's general deterrence, sending messages that if you engage in this kind of behavior, if you engage in violent behavior, you can speak out. You've got a First Amendment right to oppose various policies and principles of the government. You can speak out in opposition to candidates, in favor of others. That is your right. You can protest, but you cannot be violent about it. That's the line. That's the line that is drawn by our Supreme Court, by our courts in understanding the First Amendment. And you cannot engage in violence. You cannot incite violence as a part of your First Amendment expression. Mr. Poplin obviously engaging in violent behavior, nowhere near any First Amendment protections, and now facing some serious prison time if indeed he is convicted. That's the general deterrence that should come, the messaging sent to all Americans about what happens if you engage in this behavior in the future, in the immediate present, as we look forward to the election in November and matters, events, developments that happen after that, hopefully all peaceable, hopefully all articulating on behalf of all kinds of people, favorable results, unfavorable results, depending upon your views of the election results, but not violent behaviors. That is not a part of the First Amendment. That is not a part of our Constitution. And you will be charged and you'll be found guilty in a court of law for doing that kind of thing. As Amicus, a law review continues, we'll talk about two other matters in the federal and state courts this past week, including things in Georgia and in Cook County of just this past week involving Donald Trump, a candidate for the presidency of the United States. You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west, northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898. But 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids' home of Nightlight with Peach Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. In the last segment of our first hour here on our weekend broadcast, talking again about Donald Trump. Why? Because he is much in the news, not only for his campaign, but also in the courts of America. We know that he is charged with criminal conduct in three cases. He has been convicted in a fourth case, that coming out of New York. Sentencing scheduled now by Juan Merchan for late November in that case. Three others pending against him, again, presumed innocent until proven guilty in those other cases, including this case, this omnibus RICO case, this RICO violation case, still pending in Fulton County, Georgia, alleging violations of state law by him and many others for attempting to subvert the voter preference in the state of Georgia. That case being handled by Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee. He's the trial judge who's presiding over that matter. You may recall, well, lots and lots of fireworks, if you will, in that courtroom when allegations were made that Fani Willis, the prosecutor, should no longer be able to prosecute the case because of her romantic private relationship with one of her colleagues, her deputy, candidly, in the prosecution of that case. In the end, after hearings and motions and briefings by the parties, Scott McAfee determining that Fani Willis did not engage in conduct that presented a true conflict of interest under ethics laws or under Georgia law, but did have an appearance of impropriety. And so as a result of that, that companion, that colleague inside the prosecution team, he resigned, and Fani Willis continues to prosecute the case. But that decision went up to the appellate court there in Georgia, and that's where it's pending right now, an attack on Judge Scott McAfee's decision by the defense, saying, no, he should have thrown out the case entirely at a minimum, as should have compelled Fani Willis to remove herself from that case. That's what's up on appeal right now. In addition, just this past week, Scott McAfee, not dealing with things, obviously, on appeal because he no longer has jurisdiction as to those, but still working on other things related to the underlying case, including many of the remaining charges of the indictments against Donald Trump and many, many others. Just this past week, Scott McAfee getting a lot of attention for dismissing three more charges in those Georgia election indictments in the interference case there against Donald Trump and other people. Specifically, Scott McAfee, in a separate ruling, determines that the bedrock charge in the indictment, racketeering, that remains in place. That doesn't change at all. But there are three dismissed counts. There are 14, 15, and 27. All of them have to do with filing false documents in a federal court, And Donald Trump is charged with two of those three counts. The judge basically invoking, believe it or not, an 1890s case that talks about the interests of the state prosecution and the federal prosecution, said these things that are alleged in counts 14 and 15 and 27, those all have to do with federal matters, false documents in federal court. One of those has to do with statements made by Donald Trump and John Eastman in a federal court, for example. And Scott McAfee finding that those things are not properly within the purview of a state court. Those are federal interests. So he dismisses those counts based upon the supremacy clause of the United States Constitution. Federal law being supreme to state court, state law yielding to federal law when the two are conflicting, invoking again supremacy clause, an 1890s case that arguably supports that same result. You may recall well that McAfee previously dismissed six other counts in the indictment. 32 felony counts still remain in the wake of all of this. Those six other counts were premised upon Scott McAfee's finding that they were badly drafted, whether by the grand jury, most likely by Fannie Willis and her staff. Have to provide the defendants with more information in the charging document itself about the basis for those charges. And he said as long as that information is not provided in that charging document, there's a due process problem. You're not telling the defendants exactly what they did. And because of that, again, Scott McAfee, way back in March, dismissed six other counts in the indictment. Those remain also on appeal, that decision by Fannie Willis, being appealed by Fannie Willis from Scott McAfee. And so altogether now he has dismissed nine counts, but Donald Trump will still face eight felony counts, down from 13 in the original indictment, and many other defendants, again, also continuing to face charges under that sweeping RICO charge, that RICO indictment. The Georgia Court of Appeals is going to hear oral arguments in December to consider whether Willis will remain on the case, perhaps some of these other issues related to the legitimacy of these counts now being dismissed by Scott McAfee, affecting the prosecution, but certainly not stymieing it in any material way. The major cases, the major charges remain intact, but significant once again that Scott McAfee continuing to work on the progress of that case, even though there is no trial date. We'll presumably hear from the appellate court there in Georgia sometime in 2025, maybe returning this to the trial court and Scott McAfee for further proceedings, depending upon what it does with the particular case, including the status of the prosecutor herself, Fannie Willis. Interesting things going on there in Georgia, even as these other cases continue to move apace, slowly but surely nonetheless. And then we also have another interesting case coming out of Northern Illinois, just to the south of us here in Wisconsin, affecting, frankly, all of us, however, in the United States of America, especially those people in Cook County and people in downtown Chicago. In just this past week, a major opinion issued by a Cook County judge ruling that the Trump International Hotel and Tower, located right there on the river, on the Chicago River, right downtown in the loop area there, just across the river, violated the Illinois Environmental Protection Act. Way back in 2018, Friends of the Chicago River and others had sued, alleging that the operation of the Trump Tower, with respect to cooling water, its intake and permitting violations, had happened during a routine permit review there. Trump Tower ignored and violated federal and state laws and regulations that require buildings using systems like Trump Towers to be designed to minimize impacts on aquatic life, secure permits, operate with protective measures that are required under the law. All of that, according to the allegations and the findings now by a judge that the Trump Tower had failed to abide by the requirements of the Illinois state law. By failing to follow permit requirements, thousands of fish and other aquatic organisms died after being sucked into the building's cooling system, according to the findings of the judge, by the intake structure actually trapped against its screens. The decision by Judge Wilson, Judge Thaddeus Wilson, found that Trump committed a continuing public nuisance through a series of failures to comply with state and federal law dating back to 2008. That, again, a civil case coming out of the Cook County Court.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll review the sports news of the week, as well as Governor Tim Walz in Superior. Let you know what happened. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Join our advertising family on WFHR and WIRI and see how radio can help improve awareness, revenue, and staffing for your business. I'm Ashley, and it's my mission to help our area businesses thrive. Call me today, 715-496-0710.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast form? Search no more. Find it now on WFHR.com. Your news, just for Wisconsin Rapids and surrounding communities. I'm Melissa Kay with WFHR News.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.